Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about walnuts. Yes, walnuts. And bear with me because I'm going to tell you a long chronicle about, it speaks to the health benefits of walnuts, but it also speaks to the current regulatory environment, governmental control over statements that are true about the vitamins, the supplements, even the foods that we eat. The control is very pervasive. I'm going to read you right now a warning letter dated February 22nd, 2010, that was sent to Michael Mendez, who's president and chief executive of Diamond Food, Inc., a major manufacturer of nuts, in particular, walnuts. And here it is. Remember, the date is February 22nd, 2010, just over 3 years ago. Dear Mr. Mendez, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, has reviewed the label for your Diamond of California shelled walnuts products and your website at www.diamondnuts.com. Based on our review, we've concluded that your walnut products are in violation of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and the applicable regulations in Title 21, Code of Federal Regulations 21 CFR. Based on the claims made on your firm's website, we've determined that your walnut products are promoted for conditions that can cause them to be drugs, because these products are intended for use in the prevention, mitigation, and treatment of disease. The following are examples of the claims made on your firm's website under the heading of a page stating, quote, omega-3s. Every time you munch a few walnuts, you're doing your body a big favor. Studies indicate, and these are quotes from the Diamond Foods website that FDA doesn't like. Studies indicate that the omega-3 fatty acids found in walnuts may help lower cholesterol, protect against heart disease, stroke, and some cancers, ease arthritis and other inflammatory diseases, and even fight depression and other mental illnesses. Omega-3 fatty acids inhibit the tumor growth that is promoted by the acids found in other fats. In treating major depression, for example, omega-3s seem to work by making it easier for brain cell receptors to process mood-related signals from neighboring neurons. The omega-3s found in fish are thought to be responsible for the significant lower incidence of breast cancer in Japanese women as compared to women in the United States. Remember, these are statements that these are true statements. These are truthful scientific statements. But remember, these are statements that the FDA does not like. And therefore, a letter from this section of the FDA entitled Inspections, Compliance, Enforcement, and Criminal Investigations. They continue, because of these intended uses, your walnut products are drugs. Walnuts are now drugs. Within the meaning of Section 201 G1B of the Act, 21 U.S.C. and 321 G.B., your walnut products are also new drugs under Section 201P of the Act, because they are not generally recognized as safe and effective for the above-referenced conditions. Therefore, under Section 505A of the Act, they may not be legally marketed with the above claims in the United States without an approved new drug application. Additionally, your walnut products are offered for conditions that are not amenable to self-diagnosis and treatment for individuals who are not medical practitioners. Therefore, adequate directions for use cannot be written so that a layperson can use these drugs. Here we're talking about walnuts, remember. They cannot use these drugs safely for their intended purposes. Thus, your walnut products are also misbranded under Section 502F1 of the Act, in that the labeling for these drugs, remember we're talking about walnuts, fails to bear adequate directions for use. So what they're saying is they're drugs, and if they prove that they're efficacious, then the walnut package will have to have directions. Take 3 walnuts, with meals twice daily. Your walnut products are also misbranded under Section 403R1B of the Act because your firm's website also contains several additional unauthorized health claims. The following are examples of the claims made on your firm's website. Studies have also shown that omega-3s may lower the risk of stroke. And there's good evidence that omega-3s can increase HDL, good cholesterol, further reducing the risk of stroke and heart disease. I'm going to continue with this warning letter. Further, your Diamond of California shelled walnut product is misbranded under Section 403R1B of the Act in that your product bears health claims that are not authorized by the FDA. The front and the back of your product label bears the phrase omega-3 2.5 grams per serving. Within the context of this label, and heart symbols adjacent to information about the amount of omega-3 in the product constitute implied health claims about consumption of omega-3 and reduced risk of coronary heart disease. The back of your product also bears the following statement. The omega-3 in walnuts can help you get the proper balance of fatty acids your body needs for promoting and maintaining heart health. In fact, according to the Food and Drug Administration, supported but not conclusive research shows that eating 1.5 ounces of walnuts per day as part of a low saturated fat and low cholesterol diet and not resulting in increased caloric intake may reduce the risk of coronary heart disease. The FDA doesn't like the results of a study that they themselves conducted. This statement suggests that the evidence supporting a relationship between walnuts and coronary heart disease is related to the omega-3 fatty acid content of walnuts. There is not sufficient evidence to identify a biologically active substance in walnuts that reduces the risk of coronary heart disease. Therefore, the above statement is an unauthorized health claim. This letter is not intended to be an inclusive review of your products and their labeling. It is your responsibility to ensure that all of your products comply with the Act, capital A, and its implementing regulations. You should take prompt action to correct these violations. Failure to do so may result in regulatory action without further notice. Such action may include, but is not limited to, seizure or injunction. So the FDA is going to come in with guns and seize all their walnuts. Please respond in writing within 15 working days. Yada, 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 yada. All right. So pretty draconian warning letter from the FDA. Remember, the date is February 22, 2010. I now refer you to the Journal of the American College of Nutrition. The date is December 2012. Okay? Original research. There's an article in it. Effects of walnuts on endothelial function in overweight adults with visceral obesity, a randomized controlled crossover trial. The study, done at Yale University in Derby, Connecticut. The researcher, Dr. David Katz, who's been a guest here on Health Talk. He's a well-known researcher and looks at natural therapies as well as conventional therapies in his role exploring integrative medicine at Yale University. And so in this article, what they did was, they did essentially what the FDA wants them to do, which is develop evidence that walnuts really are good for cardiovascular conditions and for the heart and for circulatory problems. But even with the results of this study that I'm about to share with you, even if they put the results of this on the walnut package, the FDA would still clamp down on them because they would say, wow, now you've proven that walnuts really are effective for heart disease. They're a drug. And you haven't applied through our arduous and expensive FDA approval process that costs several hundred million dollars for the vast majority of medicines that we see approved by the FDA. You haven't gone through that process, so you can't claim that walnuts are effective for a disease condition. So here we go. 46 participants were recruited. And what they did was either they gave them walnuts or they didn't give them walnuts. And then they crossed it over. The group that got walnuts didn't have walnuts, and the group that didn't have walnuts got walnuts. Pretty simple experiment. And it was blinded. So in terms of the researchers looking at it, I mean, obviously people know that they got walnuts. But when you have a crossover study, it's hard to imagine that it's just a placebo effect, right? So what they did is they measured a bunch of things in these folks. And in particular, they measured something called endothelial function. And you can measure endothelial function. Endothelial function is the function of blood vessels and how blood flows through the body. And whether there's good flow or poor flow is a measure of the strength and health of your circulatory system. So, for example, in similar studies, they've demonstrated that after you smoke a couple of cigarettes, your endothelium doesn't function well. You have poor circulation. Or after a fatty meal, such as the meal that might have done in James Gandolfini recently, endothelial function actually takes a turn for the worse, thus compromising circulation, and in particular in the coronary arteries. So anyway, the available artery is in the arm, and they can measure brachial artery endothelial function by using a very sophisticated ultrasound scanning machine. And that's how they do it in scientific experiments. And what they found was quite interesting. They found that there was an improvement in the endothelial function in overweight adults who had at least one sign of metabolic syndrome. That would be high blood pressure or overweight or elevated blood sugar, high triglycerides. These are the signs of metabolic syndrome. These are precisely the people that we want to protect from cardiovascular disease. And they gave them about 1.5 ounces of walnuts per day, which is a reasonable amount of walnuts to consume. Actually, I regularly consume walnuts. I often put walnuts on my salad. I get some walnuts and I crumble them on salad, sometimes with a little bit of goat cheese. Sometimes I make a salad with beets and, of course, lettuce, goat cheese, maybe some sliced onions, and crumble some walnuts on top. It's a great way to get your walnuts. You can eat them straight or you can take them with food. So what they discovered is that the daily addition of 1.5 ounces of walnuts to the diet for 8 weeks improved the endothelial function in these overweight adults. And although they were getting additional calories, you might think, oh my goodness, you know, there's a lot of calories in walnuts and that all those extra walnuts would make you gain weight. But it turned out they didn't gain any weight. There was actually a slight decline in their waist circumference, in their belt size, when they consumed the walnuts. And here's some other things that they found. They found that there was, as I said, no change in weight. They didn't lose weight, but they added calories. The cholesterol went down slightly. The triglycerides went down pretty significantly. The fasting blood sugar went down slightly, and systolic blood pressure went down 3 points, and diastolic blood pressure went down 4 points. This is with these walnuts that the Food and Drug Administration considers dangerous contraband, worthy of seizure and confiscation because of truthful claims about their health benefits. So, you know, I ask you, what's this country coming to when we have a government bureaucracy that is involved in persecuting food manufacturers that are simply trying to bring factual information to consumers about the health benefits of their products? I mean, it's not like some Coca-Cola manufacturer is telling untruthfully their Coca-Cola consumers that Coca-Cola is actually good for you, that it makes you smarter, or that Coca-Cola helps you to lose weight, or that Coca-Cola will promote blood circulation. No, these are truthful claims based in science. The warning letter went out February 22nd, 2010, and undaunted walnut researchers have come back resoundingly with a study at the end of 2012 that documents the health benefits of walnuts. Do you think that your next walnut package will bear helpful and truthful information about the heart-healthy benefits of walnuts as a result? Think again, because you live in the United States under the boot heel of the Food and Drug Administration, which does not allow food manufacturers to even make truthful claims based in science on the health benefits of their products. What a country. Okay, the age-old question is how long am I going to live, right? And people have been going to fortune tellers for millennia, and palm readers will look at your lifeline and they'll say, oh, you have a nice long lifeline, you have longevity. Or alternatively, in ancient Rome, they sacrificed animals and looked at their entrails to determine your fortune. And these days, what we do is we rely on scientific tests, tests which tell us, oh, you have good cholesterol, or you have good blood sugar, or you have this, that, or the other trait that will enable you to live a long time. But there's no sure way to prognosticate. And a lot of people attribute their aging success, you know, those people who become centenarians, to either religious orientation, or they have lots of friends that they keep in touch with. They stay active. They exercise. They follow a good diet. For some people, it's a they follow a vegetarian diet and they swear by it. Other people say that staying off of alcohol has ensured their longevity. For others, they say that they make sure that they have a drink every day, and even at 105, they're still going to have a little shot of schnapps to make sure that they live a long time. And so theories vary as to what's going to make you live long. But researchers, among them, Dr. Nir Barzilay, who's at my alma mater, he's director of the Institute for Aging Research at Albert Einstein College of Medicine up in the Bronx here in New York City. He has gathered together a large number of oldsters, people who have lived well into their 90s and past 100. The vast majority of them are Ashkenazic Jews. And one of the reasons that they're particularly looking at that group is they're trying to find genetic traits. And they figure that Ashkenazic Jews are genetically similar. They come from one part of the world. They haven't intermarried. And therefore, there may be some specific genetic traits that they can pin down that will be testable. Maybe in the future we'll be able to do a blood test to determine whether we have longevity potential or not. And they're having some problems because it's a very, very complex problem. Researchers say that longevity is, quote, a messy trait that may be too complicated to explain with a small number of genetic variants. Well, they've actually identified quite a lot of genetic variants that may have something to do with longevity. 281 genetic variants that are measurable via genetic profiling. And they say that looking at all these genetic variants together, they can actually prognosticate who will live to be 105 or more with about 85% accuracy. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. But the paper is controversial. Actually, it was challenged in the journal Science, and it had to be pulled. It was retracted because the journal said that it was not up to par. That's very unusual. The paper was published, then it was challenged, then it was withdrawn. But these tests, obviously, are not available, and it's not even likely that these tests will be made available in the near future. But the researchers comment on one test that is kind of a cool test. If you're only going to do one test, the test that can determine with some degree of accuracy whether you have a good chance of making it well into your 90s or 100 is a test that is commonly available. It's a test that I perform in my office. It's something called the APOE test, spelled APOE. The APOE gene is a gene that codes for either longevity or, if it's not a good result, may actually code for higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. There are actually four variants of the APOE gene, in particular 2, 3, and 4. And APOE4 is not a good one to have because actually each person gets two copies of the ApoE gene. So if you have a double hit on ApoE4, it puts you at much higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. That's a very scary result to have. And we actually have to counsel patients very carefully. Are you sure you want this test? Because you got to get ready for some real bad news if you're, you know, say you have a family history of Alzheimer's disease and you want to see if you're at risk and you do the ApoE test and you get either ApoE4, one copy or double trouble with two copies, that puts you at higher risk for premature Alzheimer's disease and circulatory problems. However, there's another variant of ApoE, which is ApoE2. And if you've got one copy, or better yet, two copies of ApoE2, that actually bodes very well for you because, according to the research, it meets statistical standards for separating supercentenarians from people with a more average lifespan. Now, there's another genetic variant called ApoE3, and I actually find ApoE3 a pretty good gene for determining whether people should be on a low-carbohydrate diet. If you have one, or particularly if you have two copies of ApoE3, you're more likely to really require carb restriction. In contradistinction to that, there's actually some studies that suggest that if you have ApoE4, you may want to go low-fat. Not necessarily high carb, but low fat. High fat diets for ApoE4 individuals who are at high risk for Alzheimer's disease. Studies have suggested that they may actually be at a higher risk for brain deterioration if they consume lots and lots of fat because of the oxidizing potential of fat in the brain. And so obviously we need more research on this, but it's interesting that research has revealed that there are tests that can help us determine if you've got a long lifeline or a short one. Have you noticed that in drug ads these days, they used to say, ask your doctor about such and such a drug. But these days, they say, ask your health practitioner or ask your health provider about this or that or the other drug, because what's happening is there's a tremendous doctor shortage. And as we bring more and more people on stream with Obamacare, we're going to see more and more non-MDs with the authority to write prescriptions. And currently this is available in some states for naturopathic doctors. They can prescribe certain things, not everything. It's available for physician assistants and nurse practitioners, and it's available for foot doctors, certain things they can prescribe. But it's not available for speech-language assistants, music and art therapists, or veterinarians. I mean, veterinarians can prescribe for animals, but they can't prescribe for people. And unfortunately, these were the findings of a recent study that was undertaken under the auspices of Medicare. In 2009, massage therapists, athletic trainers, chiropractors, and other professionals wrote hundreds of thousands of drug prescriptions without having the authority to do so. In some cases, these were controlled substances. I'm reading from an article from ABC News. But Medicare Part D, which covers prescription drugs, paid for them anyway. Drugs including highly addictive oxycodone. Here are some of the health and health-related professionals who did not have the authority to write prescriptions under Medicare's rules. Massage therapists, athletic trainers, dietitians, audiologists, opticians, contractors, home health aides, interpreters, transportation companies. That's great. That's the that's the person who brings you in the ambulette to your doctor, right? And they wrote you a prescription. I forgot to ask the doctor for a prescription. Can you please write a prescription for me for my medication? Sure, no problem. Lodging companies, speech language assistants, music and art therapists, nursing technicians, and of course there are veterinarians. So this the total in terms of the amount expended, and probably this is just the tip of the iceberg, $5.4 million for 72,000 of these prescriptions nationwide. Another $26 million was paid out for prescriptions written by social workers, chiropractors, physical therapists, occupational therapists, and counselors. That's another group of professionals who don't have the authority to prescribe drugs. In 10 states that actually account for the bulk of Medicare payments, those are California, Florida, New York, Texas, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, North Carolina, Michigan, and New Jersey. And here's an example. In 2009, a Florida massage therapist wrote 3,756 prescriptions for drugs. An interpreter wrote 1,210, and an Ohio social worker ordered 1,639. That's a heck of a lot more prescriptions than I've written in the past 5 or 10 years. Congress is looking into it. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, led by Chairman Tom Carper, Democrat from Delaware, and Tom Corburn, who's a Republican from Oklahoma, will hold a hearing on the report. So, check it out, because it's easy to get a prescription these days. And sometimes the wrong people are writing prescriptions. Last time I checked, it was just for doctors and their designated nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and a few naturopaths in some states where that's authorized. I'm a World War II buff, and in commemoration of the invasion of Normandy, the successful beginning of the culmination of World War II that occurred on June 6, I began to read a book called The Guns at Last Light, The War in Western Europe, 1944 to 1945, by Rick Atkinson. It's part of a three-part trilogy about World War II. It's an excellent history, and it's a very vivid accounting of the battles and also the personalities that were involved in the war. Roosevelt, Churchill, Eisenhower, Montgomery, Omar Bradley, Charles de Gaulle, they're all very, very wonderfully described in this book. And the reason I'm bringing this up as part of intelligent medicine is 69 years have passed since 1944, and it's 68 years since 1945, which is the year of the death, the shocking death of President Franklin Roosevelt, which shocked the country at a time when he was leading the United States to eventual victory in Europe and then in the Pacific, and the United States suddenly lost its leader, the third term of his presidency. He had led the country that's actually, a lot of people couldn't remember anyone else who was the leader of the country. So it was a very shocking situation. And nobody knew in those days how sick Roosevelt was. And it's kind of a comment on how we treat health confidentiality in the present time, or just privacy and confidentiality in general. We know every detail, practically, of our presidents and our leaders' health. And if something were to go wrong, we would see it because of the constant scrutiny that these people undergo on TV and the media. They would just not look right. People would say, oh, the president looks a little wan or a little ashen. He's not forming sentences. His vigor has declined. It would be very, very apparent, even if the press were asked for national security purposes to cover it up. But it was a different time. People were under less media scrutiny, and there were definitely national security considerations in 1944. United States and the Allies wanted to project to the Axis power that everything was hunky-dory, that their leaders were in excellent health and firmly at the tiller, in full control of their army's efforts to fight the enemy. And so it never came to light until the shocking and surprising death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his third term, that Roosevelt was sick. And so they actually describe how Roosevelt looked during the Yalta conference. If you remember, there was a conference towards the end of World War II in Yalta, which is a resort on the Black Sea, where the leaders of the Allies got together, Stalin, Churchill, and FDR, and they basically hammered out what Europe and the world would look like in the post-war years. And there's actually been a lot of discussion about how Stalin may have pulled one over on the Western Allies, on Churchill, whose country was pretty banged up and he didn't have a lot of leverage, and on Roosevelt, who had a lot of leverage because the United States was a strong, robust country that was leading the charge in Western Europe. But he was very sick. And observers at the Yalta conference report that sometimes he just seemed spaced out. He just seemed unfocused and exhausted and unable to go toe-to-toe with crafty and vigorous Joe Stalin, who knew precisely what he wanted, which was domination over Eastern Europe. But here's a description of Roosevelt on his way to the Yalta conference by a contemporary. "I was shocked by Roosevelt's physical appearance. He was not only frail and desperately tired, he looked ill. I never saw Roosevelt look as bad as he did then, despite a week's leisurely voyage at sea." It's Rick Atkinson, the author of The Guns of the Last Light, describes the situation with FDR's health. He says, "Not for decades would it be revealed that his blood pressure had climbed from 128 over 82 in 1930 to 260 over 150 in December 1944. Actually, I misspoke. He actually, unbelievably, had just been elected for a fourth term. In the past year, he had shed nearly 30 pounds. He complained that, "I can't eat. I cannot taste food." An examination by a cardiologist disclosed a bluish discoloration of his skin, lips, and nail beds. That's cyanosis, which is always a bad sign. When you have cyanosis, it means there's not adequate blood circulating. With labored breathing, bouts of abdominal distress, and symptoms of an enlarged heart and fluid in the lungs, all leading to a diagnosis of congestive heart failure. So this is a perfect scenario for a major heart attack or stroke. Way out of control blood pressure and an overworked heart. Years of poorly controlled high blood pressure had caused his heart to enlarge, and it was weakening, and there was a lot of swelling. What was compounding the problem was that he couldn't get up and walk around. I mean, literally half of his body was like a block of wood. He was paralyzed from the chest down. And so all that, his lower extremities were like dead wood, accumulating fluid, and unable to circulate the blood back up. In addition, he suffered from chronic bleeding hemorrhoids, which were worsened because he was always sitting, couldn't get up and walk. And he suffered symptoms of a mild heart attack in August of 1944 while giving a speech in Washington State. So how was he treated? Well, for various ailments, he was treated with phenobarbital and injections of codeine. Those are simply pain relievers. They don't do anything to help the heart. The medication that he got, little green pills of digitalis. Digitalis is an old-fashioned heart medication that's actually from a plant source. And it is one of the first cardiac medications. It actually helps the heart beat more vigorously. And so he was sort of propped up with digitalis. By the way, digitalis is still in continuous use for heart failure 70 years later under the name Digoxin. It's a more standardized formula than what was then available in 1945. Roosevelt, of course, disregarded his doctor's suggestions that he curtail smoking. They said at least keep it down to just 10 cigarettes a day and make sure you don't have more than a couple of cocktails. But he was on his way towards a serious, serious calamitous death as he headed off to Yalta to negotiate with Stalin over the fate of Europe. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. If you like what you've heard, please spread the word. Podcasts are available at drhoffman.com and now also through iTunes. Until the next time, stay healthy.